headlines, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution highlights the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and says a country will face a pressing need for nuclear energy in the future. In Albania, police notify the U.S. Embassy of the MKO terrorist cult's involvement in human and drug trafficking. U.S. police in New Jersey are under fire for their racially motivated response to a scuffle between two teens, one black and the other white. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, rejects Western claims that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapon, once again confirming that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful.
انرژی هسته‌ای که میدونن هم صلح آمیزه حالا اسم بیارن که این تولید بمب فلان قدر فاصله داره حرفای مهمل و بی‌معناست خودشون میدونن که ما دنبال این قضیه نیستیم دنبال سلاح هسته‌ای نیستیم ما دنبال بهره‌مندی صلح آمیز از هسته‌ای هستیم این رو فهمیدن تشخیص میدن نمیخوان ملت ایران این پیشرفت بزرگ و چشمگیر علمی رو بهش دست پیدا کنه و فشار میارن.
Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that Iran will further develop its peaceful nuclear capacity to maintain its independence. Sooner or later, the leader added, the Islamic Republic will be in need of nuclear energy. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled that he had cautioned the negotiators to include certain points in the initial deal when it was being drawn up back in 2015, but that those cautions were not heeded and therefore led to subsequent problems. Iran's leader said the chief purpose of the sanctions is to weaken the Islamic Republic. He pointed out to production, collective efforts, and diplomacy as a way forward to neutralize the effects of economic pressure and sanctions. But to further delve into the comments of Ayatollah Khamenei, we're now joined by Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, who is a political analyst joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have journalist and political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, who is joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Khoshchesh in Tehran. It's great to have you with us here. Let's go over some of the key points and comments mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. He did stress once again that Tehran's nuclear program is entirely peaceful and that Iran is not seeking nuclear weapons. Help us better understand those comments.
Hello, Verdia. Thanks for having me. Well, what the Iranian leader said was reiterating, he was reiterating once again that Iran is very much resolved to maintain its peaceful nuclear program, despite the many inspections that have been carried out on Iranian nuclear, civilian nuclear industries. That included the largest number of man hours of inspections before the JCPOA and after that, of course. United States is just using Iranian nuclear order to demonize Iran without providing any kind of proof in order to advance its containment program that consists of the ultimate objective of containing Iran's power components in various areas of nuclear industry, regional power and missile power. So Iran is in the know. Iran knows what they are doing, and it wants to, you know, diffuse their containment plan if possible. If not, as the Iranian Supreme Leader reiterated, the main road towards salvation and getting rid of these pressures is diffusing the sanctions and the impact of this weapon of choice for the United States. That's reinvigorating the Iranian economy. Iran has very detailed plan for developing and reinvigorating its national economy, and also through expanding ties with the regional states, with China, Russia, Latin America, Africa, And this plan has already started under the administration of President Raisi. But more interesting to me was the kind of message that he had for the current talks in Vienna.
Said Mohsen Abbas in London. The leader, he highlighted stopping economic pressure on the Islamic Republic by neutralizing sanctions and using diplomacy to remove them. However, the main issue, he said, is neutralizing them all. What can you tell us about the significance of these comments, given the timing of it all, with all the negotiations taking place to revive the JCPOA in Vienna?
Well, there are murmurs that there has been significant progress in Vienna, and the stumbling block, of course, is still the United States of America, which can't give any real pathway towards, if you like, confirming trust in its ability to actually carry through any agreement that they do even reach, because that's a fundamental problem. America walked out of this agreement without any recourse to international, norms, diplomacy, and such things, and they still can't give those guarantees. If those guarantees can't be given, how on earth can the Iranians trust them again? So, Ayatollah Khamenei is absolutely right to make a point of caution for negotiators there, as well as for the Iranian people and for the world at large, to say, look, we can't just blindly go into dealing with America, given how unreliable they are in terms of delivering on anything that they promise. So that's very important. But I think it is also very important that Ayatollah Khamenei admonishes, I think, some of the people who went headlong into trusting American negotiators and various others, these kind of things shouldn't have happened in the first place if things had been watertight, if the agreement had been actually really, really watertight in preventing America from walking out so easily. So again, that mistake can't be made once more, and the way to avoid it is absolutely correct, that you cannot rely on who is your declared enemy. I mean, America, let's face it, neoliberals, the neoconservatives, they have not changed their stance towards Iran. They are, fundamentally opposed to the Islamic revolution, to its ideals, to its establishment. They're fundamentally committed to overthrowing the establishment as it stands. And so you have to bear that in mind, that you're dealing with your arch enemy, and behind your arch enemy is an even worse enemy. The Israelis, who are nuclear militarized to the maximum, not pressured at all, are on no negotiating table to actually account for all the 400 plus nuclear arms, which largely probably pointed now at Iran itself. So where's that in the equation, in the mix? I mean, the Iranians would be perfectly within their rights to raise Israel, who is the main regional nuclear threat, to come also into the agreement. In fact, I think the Iranians are being very, very gentle with them, with the JCPOA, even as it stands, letting them very much off the hook. So I'd say Ayatollah Khamenei's cautionary note is really one to say, look, remember who you're dealing with, and make sure that you don't sell yourselves short, and you have nothing to fear, because you are in a unique position, as Iran is, to create a new kind of resistance, non-neoliberal controlled economy, and a nation that remains sovereign and independent because of that.
Back to Mr. Khoshesh. The leader, he said that his points in his speech today, he said his points were not observed initially when the JCPOA was being drawn up, and following that, problems occurred. Can you tell us what these points were?
As a matter of fact, he made 9 conditions for the Rouhani administration to show respect for these 9 red lines, or even 11 red lines. Sometimes we refer to them in more details. But the most important one was never be optimistic about the United States showing responsibility towards any kind of deal with the outside world. Never trust the United States, and never be optimistic about it, because the U.S. would withdraw from any kind of agreement, and the U.S. has proved to be irresponsible party. The U.S. believes that it's exceptional, that it's the top world nation, and they would turn the table over. And Rouhani administration didn't respect that very much. Also, the Iranian leader stressed and warned the Rouhani administration against any kind of haste. So these two eventually led up to the Obama administration defiance, actually, and non-compliance in real terms with the JCPOA undertakings, and also the Trump administration exit from the nuclear deal. And John Kerry said on NPR, the national radio of the United States, at around the same time that Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, that even if we had been in office, we would have withdrawn from the JCPOA if Iran hadn't been present in the talks over its missile program and regional power. So this is a reality. Biden administration is no shy of revealing that he means to contain all Iranian power components in these various areas. So, but by that, the Iranian leader was sending a direct message, because this team and this administration is very much, you know, from those that were critical of President Rouhani administration's policy, especially with regard to the United States and JCPOA. So they do have very much respect for these, you know, red lines. But the Iranian leader's remarks could be interpreted or implied as some kind of direct and stressed message to the United States that now that we are at very crucial moments in Vienna talks, the main challenge has arrived. The two sides are, you know, heading on towards the main peak of confrontation in this challenge of negotiations over mainly one aspect or several aspects of assurances, as well as parts of the sanctions that Iran has been requesting to be removed. The Americans are using every possible means on the political scene, one of them being the Israelis' presence in the Vienna in order to pressure Iran. One of the others is dismantling the team when Richard Nephew and some others separated from the team. These are all messages of, and instruments used by the United States in order to pressure Iran and send the message to Iran that these are the final moments. We are not going to withdraw. Now, Iran may not withdraw from these red lines. If the Americans really mean to have a, you know, deal, they should guarantee a lasting deal. And by that, we do not mean at all just a congressional approval, a statement, something like that. Everyone knows that John Kerry or Biden's signature and endorsement matter nothing. You know, they have already proved it. But we need them to show that they lament, that they regret what they've been doing to Iran. They say it, but they have kept the pressure intact. They continue the maximum pressure policy. They should show that they regret what Donald Trump did. And if they really want a deal, they need to show up to give the assurances and guarantees. But what Iran is looking for is a complex set of guarantees. It's not just a political guarantee that Biden or the Congress might give to Iran.
Right.
It's more than that. The inherent guarantees are more important to Iran. So the message today was exactly to the Vienna talks that Tehran may not retreat from the red lines. And the final message here is that if the United States team and the U.S. administration continue this challenge in Vienna in a way that this round of talks that was supposed to be the last round ends up in another return to the capitals, then the U.S. would regret it. Tehran would be more cautious, would be more steadfast, more resolved on its demands in the sanctions removal area, and as well as in area of assurances and guarantees. So they better stick to their final chance, okay, because if the representatives and negotiating teams return to the capital, they would not earn even as much as they have so far, I mean, the Americans.
Thanks to our guest, Sayed Mostafa Khoshchesh, joining us from Tehran, and Sayed Mohsen Abbas speaking to us from the British capital, London. Elsewhere, Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks is calling on other parties to be realistic and avoid excessive demands. In a tweet, Ali Bagheri Kani says it's time for them to take, quote, serious decisions in order to restore the 2015 accord. The diplomat says the months-long negotiations are closer than ever to an agreement. However, he stresses that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. Russia's representative to the talks, Mikhail Ulyanov, has echoed Bagheri Kani's remarks, calling for final decisions to be made. Albanian police have alerted the U.S. embassy that members of a terrorist anti-Iran group known as Mojahedin Khalq organization have been involved in various criminal activities. Albanian media reports suggest some MKO operatives based in a camp near the capital, Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 members to France. A number of them have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, and that's not all. Based on these reports, some senior MKO members have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs to Italy. Police have also prosecuted another member over theft charges. The criminal activities happened between 2019 and 2021. The terrorist organization has been involved in the massacre of thousands of Iranians, including senior officials in the 1980s. Iran says Washington and some of its allies have been supporting the terrorist group. The U.S. removed MKO from its terror blacklist in 2012. Its members now enjoy freedom of activity in the U.S. and Europe, and even hold regular meetings where European and American officials make speeches. Elsewhere, U.S. law enforcement is once again facing accusations of double standards. Now a video showing officers' response to fight between two black and white teens has rekindled fears of racial bias. The footage shows the teenagers are arguing in a mall in New Jersey and police arrive to break up the brawl. Officers then tackle the black boy to the ground and handcuff him while the white teen is seated on a couch and looks on. Social media users have reacted to police behavior and slammed it as racially motivated. The New Jersey governor has described the situation as racially disparate treatment by police. Anti-racism sentiments have remained high in the U.S. following several high-profile cases of police brutality against black Americans, including the murder of George Floyd in 2020. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
We have made many achievements to this day, thanks to movement in the direction of the revolution. However, there is a long way till we reach those goals. Of course, we can attain them, provided that the train continues to move down the same railway, the same direction that Imam Rahmatullah Ali moved the train of the Islamic community. After Imam's demise, whenever we acted in a revolutionary manner, we managed to move forward. And whenever we ignored the revolutionary behavior and jihadi movement, we fell behind. We were frustrated. This was the reality. I myself was an official during those years. If there have been some flaws, this humble person is partly to blame. Whenever we preserved our revolutionary outlook, whenever we moved in a jihadi manner, and whenever we moved along the special track, we managed to move forward. On the other hand, whenever we showed negligence, we fell behind. We can catch up if we move forward in a revolutionary manner.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This message is being addressed with today's generation and to all future generations. This message is being addressed with all of us. Officials and the political, cultural and social activists are all the addressees of this statement. The youth, academic and seminarians and seminarian personalities, business people, villagers and city dwellers are all addressees of this statement. Everyone should know that this path can be taken with a revolutionary approach, and only then will progress be definite. Or we can move in a different direction, and then a dreadful fate will befall us. Imam Rahmatullah Alayh had a well-known statement he shared. He used to say, if this happens, it will be a slap in the face to Islam. If we change the path, the people of Iran will be slapped across the face, and so will Islam. There are many necessary things to say in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood made headlines once again on Sunday. Clashes broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinian residents in the area after far-right Jewish lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir opened a parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. Tens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli crackdown. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned Ben-Gvir's step as a provocative and escalating move that threatens to ignite violence. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is fully and directly responsible for the escalation in the occupied Al-Quds and potentially dire consequences of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It added that the failure of the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take necessary measures to compel Israel to stop its occupation of Al-Quds encourages the occupying power to forge ahead with its colonial Judaization projects in the Holy City.
Well, that was expected, and he did it largely as a publicity stunt and to raise his profile within Zionist politics in Israel, and of course to shove it in the face of the Palestinian Christian and Arab or Muslim community that lives in the area. But it was designed for controversy. But it definitely is a political stunt, and it's designed to increase tensions in the area. And this is most unfortunate and illegal, and mostly condemned around the world as an attempt to Judaize the area and to drive out the Palestinians.
Earlier, the Hamas resistance movement had issued a strongly worded message of warning to the Israeli regime and settlers after the latter renewed their attacks on Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Mohammed Hamadeh, a spokesman for the Gaza-based movement, said the attack amounts to a clear violation and that Israel was playing with fire. Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East Al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the holy city could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of the city and increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office, but the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al-Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq movement, Hassan Mashaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems, but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution. Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al-Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al-Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel and is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating lands from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks. As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz, in Yemen, and it's actually this is also Yemeni territory, but it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sheikh Abdullahi Jum'a wrote the book Shia and Taghiyya and introduced the true school of thought of Shia for people.
Just look at his lifestyle and look at his behavior. He said, why? For this little world, I should postpone my intention? No, I'm going to declare.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
We've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him? Mu'allim.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio. This is The Teacher, a program on the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Ziyaniya, Sheikh Mahtavi. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, Baba.
Alaikum assalam.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So very recently, this year, we missed one of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars of Kenya, who was a source of blessing, a source of benefit and help and endeavor for spreading Islam, especially in Africa and the African continent. He is no one by Abdullahi Jum'a Nasser or Abdullahi Nasser Jum'a. You know, one of the most outstanding and greatest men in the history of Islam, especially contemporary world. Okay, Sheikh Ziyaniya, give us some information about the life of Sheikh Abdullahi Nasser.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdullahi Nasser was born in 1932 in Mombasa in Kenya. He was a Sunni person at the beginning of his life. He was born in a Sunni family. And he started his Islamic studies at the very beginning years of his life. And after finishing the studies in Kenya, he was chosen as a lecturer and also a teacher in Kenya. And he was a prominent one also.
Yes.
That's why he moved to Nairobi and was chosen as the imam of the Masjid al-Jami' of Nairobi and was giving khutbah and lectures for Jum'ah prayer in that mosque.
Yes.
For many years.
Okay.
And he had also programs in radio giving lecture there. And beside these activities, he was chosen for a single period as a member of parliament of Kenya from Mombasa.
Yes.
When he was a young man.
Okay.
But and it shows that he was a popular person at that age. But after finishing that period, he decided to leave politics and decided to dedicate his life for preaching and broadcasting Islam all over his country. He was active in writing books, giving lectures, as I mentioned, in radio or in sermons of Salatul Jum'ah, and different, you know, having courses for people teaching. He, after being a very practicing Sunni Muslim, decided to convert into Shia school of thought.
Okay.
In 1975.
They say it was because reading out Al-Ghadir by Allama Amini.
Yes.
Is it?
There is an interview that in which he is questioned why you converted into Shia school of thought. And he says that I got familiar with the virtues of Amir al-Mu'minin, alayhi salatu wasalam, Ali ibn Abi Talib. And step by step, I felt that Ali ibn Abi Talib is the highest ranked Muslim amongst the companions of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he says, after a while, I read the book Al-Ghadir by late Allama Amini rahmatullah alayhi.
Okay, very good.
I studied the first volume, and that was when I understood that Shia is the true school of thought. And then I went to the mosque of Shia people to see them and to observe them.
Yes.
And after that, studied many books.
Yes.
And finally, I decided to convert into Shia.
Okay.
And it's notable that after converting, he did not announce his conversion. And he was a Shia, but he was hiding his beliefs. But after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he had a travel to Iran. And after this travel, he announced it publicly that I have converted into Shia.
Yes.
And
okay, that's all right. A really beautiful story about the life of Abdullah Nasser Jum'ah. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, politically and culturally, socially, he was active too in Kenya, isn't it? Did his conversion to the Shia Islam overshadow these activities over there, or no, he continued as before?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, definitely, and I will come to the question that you raised before we back to you. Let me complete what my brother said regarding the story of the conversion to Shiism. The moment he wanted to convert to Shiism, it was the moment actually he was invited to one of the Muslim country to be receiving the prize. And some of his friends told him, you didn't announce and declare that you are a Shia.
Okay.
Till now, it's better to postpone it for the moment you are back from this country. Let's go and get that prize. So for sure, it's going to even support you, because for sure, by the moment you are declaring that you are a Shia, you will be withdrawn from all these supports that you are getting from the Muslim communities here in Nairobi.
Okay.
But just look at his lifestyle and look at his behavior. He said, why? For this little world, I should postpone my intention? No, I'm going to declare. And it happened. Now, coming back to the question that you raised. By the moment he converted to, actually he declared and announced publicly that from now onward, I am a Shia and I am practicing Shia Islam. He was stripped of all those positions in Nairobi. As my brother mentioned, he was leading the Salat as the prominent imam for the Masjid al-Jama in Nairobi, but he was stripped of this position. He was forced to leave Nairobi to Mombasa, his homeland.
Yes.
So for a great scholar, having these positions, being actually active in the field of tabligh, to the extent that most of the Kenyan people, not people who are in this generation, the generation before that, they believe, like it or not, that they order Islam to efforts of Sheikh Abdullah Nasser, even those who are not Shia.
Okay.
Why? Because of the fluency and attractiveness of his speeches. He was known for that. That's why he would have been invited to the radio station to present his program, and it was common for all people, Muslim people, I mean, not specifically for Shia, that they would hand over their cassette tape from one person to another to get it and listen to his speech and be empowered to respond to Christian challenges against Islam. So he was such a man. He had such a role. That's why Wahhabism couldn't do anything after he converted to Shiism. And
publicly declared and announced that I am a Shia.
That's right.
So it was a big offense for them to do or start chasing after him or, I don't know, do some sort of terrorist action.
They say he was really an outstanding lecturer, you know, presenter of the Islamic content. But in what languages he presented his speeches and his members?
Yeah, actually, the local language for that Zoom is the Swahili.
Swahili, okay.
But he was actually mastering Arabic language because of being a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And also the second language in some of the countries locating in the east of the Africa, English also is either second or the first language, I mean the language people are speaking. So he was delivering speeches in all these languages,
okay,
fluently, accurately.
Very good.
That's why I was saying that many Muslims, they are owing him. Why? Because due to his speeches, they took Islam as their religion. So this is his lifestyle, and when he moved to Mombasa, he didn't stop his activities. He dedicated actually his life to school of Ahlul Bayt, defending from the school of Ahlul Bayt,
yes,
and spreading the school of Ahlul Bayt all around the all those countries, I mean Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda.
Uganda.
So he was really active.
Yes.
And he's really praised, mm-hmm, specifically by Khoja people, yes, who are residing.
He was not a Khoja himself.
No, he was not. Because we know if a foreigner is spreading or is preaching, native people barely may start communicating with him. But if someone from themselves start preaching, okay, this guy belongs to us. Uh-huh. This is from our family. But he was
right,
that attractive, even he could draw the attention of Khoja families and Khoja, mm-hmm, Federation.
Yes.
When he moved to Mombasa, actually this is a kind of ridiculous for a great scholar to deliver speeches at that level, I mean, in the actually country. But after he converted to Shiism, he moved to Mombasa, and he was actually active only in the Bilal Mission schools.
Okay.
So you see how politics work.
How politics work, that's
yes,
right. Especially over there, you know. Politically, he was after the independence of Kenya too, from the Britain, you know, isn't it? Colony.
Yeah, this is actually...
Yes.
I mean, those... natural lessons from the Islam.
Yes.
Freedom.
Freedom and independence.
Independence.
Yeah. And that's why he was loved by the people, especially by the natives of those lands. What about his works, Sheikh Ziyaniya? Can you introduce some of the works?
Yes.
Or the books or the publications of Abdullahi Nasser for us?
Yes. He had many books in Sawahili, amongst which one of the most important one is the book Shia and Taqiyya.
Mm-hmm.
That this book was written in response to the book written by Sheikh Muhabbuddin Khatib, who wrote a book that was named The Roots of School of Thought of Tashayyu.
Okay.
So, and he was accusing Shia School of Thought in this book. Sheikh Abdullahi Jum'a wrote the book Shia and Taghiyya and introduced the true School of Thought of Shia for people.
Okay.
And for example, the chapters of this book is this: what is Taqiyya, the first chapter,
mm-hmm,
and what were the problems for Shia during the caliphate of Bani Umayyah and Bani Abbas, the second chapter, and the third chapter, Taqiyya from the point of view of Ahlul Sunnah,
mm-hmm,
and the fourth chapter, Taqiyya from the point of view of Shia people.
That's right.
And because he was a prominent Sunni scholar before converting into Shia, so that's why his book was well accepted.
Yes,
another good, important point that we should mention is that more than 4,000 cassettes is remained from his lectures.
Oh, 4,000 cassette tapes.
Number, yeah.
Wow.
So he was
very
active.
Man.
He was very active. Yeah. And besides,